Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. There are a few people whose intelligence I have come to respect more, both intelligence in the sense of high and carefully refined intellect, as well as in the sense of national security mindedness and the mastery of secrets, than our guest for this full hour of this program. His name is Angelo Codevilla. He is a professor, he is an author, he is an essayist, he is a former foreign service officer. We first met when he was working for a United States senator by the name of Malcolm Wallop in connection with his responsibilities as a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee. I have been proud to know him for, 40-some years, I think it is now, and have been very, very pleased to have an excuse to catch up with him for this deep dive, among other things, into the subject of a new essay that he's written that has become the topic of enormous amounts of conversation in Washington, D.C. It's entitled Our Revolution's Logic, and it appeared at theamericanmind.org. He has addressed himself in it to topics that are particularly germane in the aftermath of this week's midterm election. And it is exciting to be able to visit with him at some length about this particular essay, but also his thinking on the broad array of issues that it raises. Angelo Codevilla, welcome back, sir. It is so good to have you.
It's good to be with you again.
So, Angelo, let me ask you about our revolution's logic. First of all, start with our revolution. I think most of us would probably say, well, that was something that took place over 200 years ago, and yet you've got in mind something different. Tell us about it.
Well, if only the revolution of 1776 had been the last one. No, we are now undergoing a different one, a revolution by really two halves of the American people against one another. The main driving force of that revolution is the disdain that the people at the top of the heap, socially and governmentally, have a feel for the rest of the country. And once the rest of the country discovered that they were deplorables, why they reacted in a Newtonian manner. Nobody likes to feel gratuitously deplored, and so they deplore back. And so there has begun a kind of vicious cycle of intolerance. And where this vicious cycle of intolerance leads, nobody knows. The only thing that is certain is that it is, as the farther it goes, the more difficult it becomes to stop.
Mm-hmm. This is in the nature of these sort of revolutionary cycles, isn't it? There would seem to me to be, in addition to the revolution, as you've sort of described it, also a counter-revolution now. And maybe that's what you've comprehended in the way you've teed it up. But the question, I guess, is it the elites that are the revolutionaries, or is it the people who are, well, being defamed as deplorables, who are the revolutionaries? Where do you assign the responsibility for this revolution?
At this point, it doesn't matter. Historically, the answer is that it is the revolt of the clerks. The leaders of this country began by despising the rest of the country, and the rest of the country followed. But it is in the nature of these revolutions that after a bit, it doesn't matter who started it. The question then becomes, how's it going to end? and that nobody knows.
So when you talk about the contempt of the elites for the American people, let's say, maybe not all of them, but very many of them, there is an equality of antipathy that seems rooted in ideology, is there not? And how would you distinguish between that motivation, Angelo, and what has been remarked as a certain similarity or shared attitude on the part of elites of both the right and the left towards the rest of us?
Well, now that you point to a very important matter, that is the similarity between the elites of the Republican and the Democratic Party. However, and it is certainly true that a whole bunch of elites who call themselves conservative would have a hard time sitting down to dinner with a blue collar worker. Nevertheless, there is not an ideological disdain on the part of conservative elites, if you want to call them that, for manual laborers, because they know they shouldn't have it. However, elites of the left, and they are in a great majority, have no such compunction. They really do believe that they are inherently superior. And they will give you all sorts of reasons why they're not. Look, I had dinner, as a matter of fact, with a lady who is quite prominent, but quite ignorant, and who tried to inform me that, quote, white trash have indices of social dysfunction far greater than blacks. And I said, look, you know, look at the U.S. Census Bureau, and the statistics there will tell you quite clearly what kinds of Americans have what indices of social dysfunction. She said, like what? I said, well, yeah, for example, you know, children born out of wedlock. He says, no, white trash far worse than blacks. Yeah, well, look, you know, blacks are born out of wedlock 72% of the time. With whites, it is approximately 25%, which, by the way, is five times higher than the rate for blacks was in the 1950s.
This is part of a dysfunction in our society, I think, as well as the sort of a concerted effort to destroy the family that has been waged, I think there's no getting around it, in part by those on the left who have sought to enslave the black and otherwise deride the rest of us. Angela, we have to pause for just a second. We're going to continue this very important conversation with Dr. Angelo Codavilla. He's talking about the revolution that is upon us and what, especially against the prism of this recent election, we best be doing about it. That and much more with Angelo right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. We are visiting for this full hour with Dr. Angelo Codavilla, an extraordinary intellect and a man whose writings have moved many of us to rethink things we thought we understood, including his important book, 2014, Peace, to Make and Keep Peace. He is also the author of a very interesting and provocative essay in the Claremont Institute's The American Mind, entitled Our Revolution's Logic. And Angela, before the break, we were discussing some of what's going on in terms of the mindset, if you will, of this this elite or ruling class. Talk about how that really defines who they've become as what as well as what they are seeking to accomplish.
What they have become and what they are seeking to accomplish is one and the same thing. Once upon a time, you could say that these people were moved by adherence to a certain ideology, Marxism, for example. But it has gone beyond that. They have very few people who graduate from college have actually read Marx or anything of the sort. What they have absorbed, above all other things, is a sense of their own superiority, which entitles them to rule those who they believe are beneath themselves. That is, the social sense is their ideology.
So when they talk endlessly, Angelo, about social justice and equality of, all men and all of that, you're really saying this is a conceit, either one that they indulge in themselves to delude themselves or to delude the rest of us.
Well, they delude themselves first and then try to delude the rest of us. It's a lot easier for them to delude themselves than to delude the rest of us into thinking that we really are their succubi. You see, it's ironic to see these terribly privileged people. And by the way, there are no more privileged people than tenured professors. I was one. acting as if they were the people. I live in a farming area. I run a farm in California. And I drive around, and all the pickup trucks have Trump signs on them. I drive to Palo Alto, where I used to live, Stanford, and all the cars there have Bernie Sanders stickers, that sort of thing. They believe that they are the people. Of course, this is crazy. These are the most privileged people on the face of the earth. And they believe they have every right to be. Why? Well, because they are who they are.
And they not only are who they are, but we are supposed to be who they tell us we are as well. Isn't that pretty much right? So, Angelo, you mentioned this election, and I would like to sort of bring this from the abstract into the very, real. We have people now elected to rule us, at least in the House of Representatives, come January, who are very much imbued, it seems to me, with this sort of sense of superiority and the entitlement to govern. And in ways that, as you were sort of suggesting, are redolent of the extreme leftism of Bernie Sanders and, Saul Alinsky and others like them. Where does this lead the revolution or the counter-revolution, as the case may be?
It leads to in a purely Newtonian sense. Every action has a corresponding and opposite reaction. This leaves the likes of us with no choice at all. It's either simply kowtowing or resisting. Look, the essence of the revolution that is occurring among us right now is that there is no satisfying their demands. They demand A, and if you satisfy A, demand B will come up. Why? Because it wasn't A in the first place that they were after. What they were after was the pleasure of making you submit. And that is a pleasure that grows as does the appetite while eating.
Yeah. At the end of the day, it's about power, isn't it? And the more you have of it, the more you want it.
It is not power for the sake of doing A or B. It is power for the sake of exercising power.
Yeah. And this really is, it seems to me, a pretty profound differentiator between people on the left and people on the right, which makes all the more peculiar the fact that some on the right in the ruling elite themselves are prepared to throw in with the left.
Well, look, it's purely social. I mean, I remember when I first came to Washington, some folks in the ruling elite noticed that maybe I wasn't inept, and I got any number of subtle offers. Look, you play ball with us, and you can have a bright future. And I said, well, yes, I know that.
It wasn't the kind of future to which you aspired, however.
No, it really wasn't, no.
Because of the submission that would be entailed?
Well, right. No, I mean, some people do have some pride. But fact is that an awful lot of people, and you having lived in Washington all these years, know this far better than I, are attracted to and give in to having the doors to the inner chamber opened. And you do pay a price for getting into the inner chamber. You simply adapt to the inner chamber. That's an easy thing to understand. I would counsel anyone who is interested in understanding that phenomenon to read C.S. Lewis's That Hideous Strength, the attraction, the fatal attraction of being in. At any rate, that's an easily explained thing. What I think should be stressed in the wake of these elections is that anybody who expects the Democrats to be nice because they have gained power should have his head examined. They can't. They can't be nice because that is no longer who they are. They are not your father's or your grandfather's Democrats. They are not anything like Scoop Jackson.
For whom, as we both recall well, I had the privilege of working a long time ago. He can only be turning at a very high RPM in his grave at what has become of his party.
You may recall that I wrote a eulogy of him for him in the U.S. Senate.
Actually, I didn't remember that. For Senator Wallop?
Malcolm Wallop's eulogy of Scoop Jackson was noted by many. I'm proud to have written it.
Well, I'm not surprised that it was noted by many if you did, in fact, write it. So there you have it. So, Angelo Codevilla, what we're addressing here has another entrant in the mix, and that would be, of course, Donald Trump. And I'm interested in your thoughts about how he figures in this revolution, counter-revolution dynamic, and not just, you know, how he has to this point, but particularly how you see him conducting himself and with what effect in the days following this election.
Well, I tell you, I am somewhat heartened. It did not appear to me for a long time that he was capable of learning. It appears that he is. In 2016, I supported Ted Cruz because I thought he understood things a lot better. Supported, of course, Donald Trump when he got the nomination with many reservations. But at the very beginning, Donald Trump simply submitted very largely to the establishment. And then he found out little by little that did not work. His administration has done nothing but improve, especially in national security. He got rid of a whole bunch of people, put in John Bolton, who was basically running the show. He's got, for the first, probably the best Secretary of Research and Engineering that we've ever had in Michael Griffin. Ignorant as he is, as Trump is, he apparently is capable of learning. Now, whether he can learn enough fast enough, God only knows. But he realizes that, again, first thing he did after these elections was to fire Jeff Sessions, who, God knows what got into him, but who hasn't been doing the right thing. Donald Trump, why did Donald Trump get elected? Donald Trump got elected because he was the one who said most clearly what most Americans felt, namely, quote, who the hell do they think they are?
It was a counter-revolutionary statement of the first order, I would argue. And he has said it, it seems, in not quite as many words, but with much the same effect in the course of the 2018 election as well, with dramatic results, I think, most especially, of course, in the Senate races. And we'll talk more about that and where this leaves us, specifically with respect to the president's policies with respect to national security, a subject in which our guest Angelo Codevilla is deeply expert. Stay tuned for more with Angelo right after this.
More with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back. It is my great pleasure to say that we are now well into a remarkable conversation with Dr. Angelo Codevilla. He has written extensively on virtually everything that matters, certainly with respect to the national interest and national security, often at the Claremont Review of Books. We've been talking about a piece that he wrote in another publication of the Claremont Institute, The American Mind, entitled Our Revolution's Logic. But Angelo, I wanted to pivot a little bit here because one of the things that you talked about a moment ago was the fact that we find ourselves being insistently told we must submit to the ruling elite. We must do what they tell us because they're so much smarter than we are. And it has had a Newtonian effect, particularly in the insurgency, I guess it might be called, of Donald Trump. But one of the things that has dogged us, it seems to me, is we still don't, many of us at least, understand fully who it is that we are submitting to. And I'm reminded that submission, of course, is not unique to the left and its agenda. It's also part and parcel of what I think of as Andy McCarthy calls them Sharia supremacists have in mind for us as well. And Islam being about submission and all that, what is your sense of the red-green dimension to this problem? That is to say, the nexus, the axis between those on the left and those in the Sharia community who seek to impose rather different agendas in the end on both of us, but on all of us, but they both have in common the idea that we should submit. We must submit.
You know, that's interesting that you mention submission to the communists and to the Islamists, because the people who want us to do that are the same people, and I assure you that they want to do it for the same reason. Look. The American pro-communists never wanted themselves to live under communism, and I assure you that the American pro-Islamists have absolutely no desire to live under Islam. Why then have they urged the rest of us to submit first to the Reds and now to the Greens? Not because they love the Reds or the Greens, but because they dislike us. That's the reason.
And they think through our submission that they will simply obtain more power and be better off and better able to call the shots.
Or it is even less reflective than that. It is simply a dislike of our civilization. And whoever the most effective enemy of our civilization is at the time, that is what they support. Again, think about that. You've got essentially the same kind of social element here in the West, not only in the United States, but in Europe as well, who now are rather pro-Islam, pro-Sharia. These are people who wouldn't last 5 minutes under Sharia, just as they would not have prospered at all under communism.
In particular, I take it you're thinking of the feminists and the homosexuals and the Jews and other apostates.
Even the Michael Bloombergs of this world. Mm.
Most especially, perhaps. Well, here's the question I wanted to get at, because you've spent much of your professional career, in addition to your academic pedagogic efforts, in the practice, or the monitoring at least, of intelligence. And I just wonder, to what extent, Angelo, do we have in our intelligence agencies at the moment an appreciation of the phenomenon of these enemies within and what they have in mind for our republic and for us? Are they up to it?
There is none of that in these agencies. These agencies are overstuffed. The people who go to work at 9 o'clock in the morning and leave at 5 o'clock and draw a paycheck and look forward to retirement. They do what they're told, what they're expected, and nothing more.
They are submitting too, in other words. This is deeply troubling, and unfortunately it tracks with my own experience, and I think all of our adversaries, foreign as well as domestic, have understood this to be a glaring shortcoming in our national security. And Angelo, again, backing the lens even further up, do you think that the overstuffed bureaucracies, as you call them, are much better at understanding those threats overseas than they are the domestic dimension of this problem?
Now, let's talk a little bit about good news. For the first time in a very long time, it appears that the Trump administration is putting together something like a coherent policy toward China and a coherent policy toward Russia. I think this is the doing of John Bolton, and these things are far from complete. These policies that are being put together are far from complete, but they seem to be going in the right direction. China, realizing that this is a comprehensive threat, not ideological in the sense that the Soviet Union was an ideological threat because it was terribly attractive to a whole bunch of Americans, but because this is a coherent, China is a coherent power pursuing a coherent strategy to essentially to take over the Pacific, which is of great interest, of inherent interest to us. And to do that, the Chinese are doing a whole bunch of things with regard to commerce and technology, as well as military. Apparently, this administration has realized exactly what is going on, and it has begun to be coherent about it. As regards Russia, the futility of a purely moralizing view of what Russia is doing in Ukraine is become apparent. And the fact that Russia aims are inherently limited is being taken into account, and the question now becomes, especially since once this proper Mueller nonsense is disposed of, just how spheres of influence can be drawn. This administration appears set on a course for drawing concrete spheres of influence in Europe. Which is common sense as far as I'm concerned.
Vis-a-vis the Russians, you're saying. But that's not possible with the Chinese?
It may be possible with the Chinese, maybe, but we haven't begun to show enough strength. China is much stronger than Russia. And it is not at this point convinced that it has to set limits with regard to expansion in the Pacific. Russia is a very weak country in many ways, and Putin is very much aware of his strengths and his weaknesses, especially his weaknesses. It is by no means clear that the Chinese see any weaknesses. They haven't been shown that there are limits to their desires.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I wanted to come back to that point. Angelo Codevilla is our guest. This is, it seems to me, harder and harder to make the case that the Chinese ambitions are limited to taking over the Pacific. That whether you look at this Belt and Road Initiative business or you look at where they're deploying commercial and ultimately military assets in strategic choke points around the world, Africa among them, Latin America for that matter, Eurasia pretty broadly defined, in fact, they seem to be seeking to reestablish the Middle Kingdom, as they call it, the center of the universe business. And I think that speaks to your point about not yet seeing that there's any limit to what they aspire to. But I just wanted to ask you this question, Angela, because I hear from a lot of our friends that there are opportunities to have a modus vivendi, for want of a better term, with the Russians. But it does seem to me that the Russians have, to this point at least, thrown in with the Chinese and are seeing their interests align more closely with the Chinese than with ours. And I just wonder what you make of that as a serious strategic thinker.
That is diplomatic problem number one, bar none. Anybody who knows the Russians at all knows that not very far under the skin is a deep and abiding anti-yellow racism. You know, you don't have to know much about the Russians to know that.
No, it's in their DNA for sure. And yet we do see Putin, you know, selling them arms and allowing them to colonize Siberia and engaging in military exercises and the like.
That's the question, you see. At a certain point, that has inherent limits. I mean, Putin is not an idiot. And so the question is, this is a challenge for intelligence with a lowercase I, to see just how far, just to understand. I don't think that our diplomacy has sought to understand just where these limits are, what these objectives are, what these limits are. What is it that drives Putin to do what?
All right. Well, let's hold that question for just a moment. We have to pause for a final break in our conversation with Dr. Angelo Codevilla, the author of, among many important works, Peace, To Make and Keep Peace. We'll be right back with more right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back for the final segment of this conversation. I hope it will be one of many in the days ahead with Angelo Codevilla, a man I've known and worked with and admired greatly for his acumen about all things strategic. And we're talking about Putin's strategy and what he is up to, what he makes of the fix he finds himself in, and the opportunities that may present to us. Angela, pick up the thought, if you would.
Vladimir Putin has pushed against mostly open doors in Eastern Europe, and he has gotten everything that is easy to get there. It is doubtful that he wants any more because he could not manage it. For example, Ukraine, the part of Ukraine that he now has is difficult enough to manage. Taking the European part of Ukraine would be far more trouble than Russia could manage or that he would want to manage. The great question is, what are his intentions with regard to China? Europe no longer poses a problem, a big problem for Russia. Russia's big problem in the long run is in Asia. It is vis-a-vis China. And yet Putin is selling arms to the Chinese and working with them against the United States. This is something that the United States ought to be trying diplomatically to see the end of. What would it take for Putin to draw back? Because both of us now, both we and the Russians, have an inherent national interest in limiting China's ambitions. So this is the primary diplomatic challenge to U.S. foreign policy.
It is of the first order, and getting it right is something that will take, of course, a competent intelligence community and a president who is able to understand and contend with some of the very real shortcomings we've been discussing to this point. And talk us through what, if you were able to have his ear, you would say to President Trump needs to be done at this moment.
First of all, I would say to assert his own power and responsibility. After all, the intelligence agencies can only recommend. At the end of the day, what is done or not done depends on him and nobody else in our system of government. In that regard, the agencies have been asserting the right to clear or not clear the people with whom he deals. This is literally a revolutionary claim on their part.
When you say with whom he deals, you mean people who he can employ and people who will work for him.
For him, exactly. If they get to decide who works for him and who doesn't work for him, either by assertion or by failure to act with clearances, then they become his masters. They become those who determine what he hears and doesn't hear. This is an abdication of power. No, he has got to realize that he is the boss, and that requires a certain intellectual self-confidence, which thus far Donald Trump has not shown. He really does need to stop being in awe of them, because these people are not awesome.
Yeah, I think this is attributable in part, at least my sense of it is, Angelo, that this is what, you know, is sort of the occupational hazard, I guess, if I could call it that, of someone who is now in high office, but who comes to it without any background in any of these matters. And there is a tendency always, I think, to defer to those who have had experience, and particularly people who have risen through the military's ranks. We've seen his very considerable admiration for and deference to senior flag and general officers. But I guess what I'm interested in is, as you look at it, and as you, I mean, this is a man who does not lack for confidence, that's for sure. And you yourself have indicated that, you know, his administration seems to be improving. It seems to be adapting. It seems to be growing. Now, it's about to face a whole new host of challenges, of course, from a Democratic-controlled House of Representatives. But it does seem that makes all the more urgent getting his house in order with respect to people who are loyal to him, working for him, not deep state or elite or ruling class or whatever you want to call them, but people who have a shared commitment with him to our country and to getting us back to the kind of, he calls it nationalism rather than globalism, I guess, but constitutionalism that has made this the greatest country on earth. So again, what would you advise him to do? Is it to fire people in the intelligence community, to give them some new direction? Is it much bigger than the intelligence community, but you have to start somewhere?
It quite concentrates the mind of bureaucrats, like firing people. So I would suggest if there's any doubt, fire people. And secondly, put in at the top people who are skeptics, who are not of their choice. Look, Donald Trump has shown a certain willfulness the American people have elected him because he's willful. However, he has not matched that willfulness with intellectual self-confidence, and there is no substitute for that. You can be as willful as you want, but if you are not sure of yourself, if you don't understand things yourself, you're screwed.
Angelo, we're almost out of time, and I would prefer to do this at greater length, so if you'll indulge me, we'll have you back. But I can't resist the temptation to simply ask very quickly for you to return to a topic that you first introduced me to 40-odd years ago, namely missile defense. This is a president who says he's committed to it. He is standing up a space force. You have talked about space-based missile defense since I've known you all these years. What would you recommend now be done in that space?
Two things. One thing I believe is going to be done, and that is not only space-based sensors, an increase in space-based sensors, but the emplacement of fire control systems for ground-based interceptors in space. The difference, as Undersecretary of Defense for Engineering Griffin has pointed out, is enormous because it allows the firing of surface-based interceptors in time to make successful intercepts. Without that, we are blind, and the ground-based interceptors are of very limited capability. The moment you put fire control systems in orbit, allowing early launches, you're in a different world, much improved. But then nothing quite substitutes for space-based weapons. In that regard, the best thing that President Trump has done is to create the Space Force. Right now, unfortunately, the head of it is an Air Force general. There is no greater enemy of missile defense than the U.S. Air Force. But that simply has to come. And again, this is a good Undersecretary of Defense Research and Engineering. But you simply can, this country will not be able to wage a serious foreign policy with regard to China or Russia without a serious missile defense. We do not have it. We have had the capability for getting it for over a generation, and it's high time we get to it.
Amen. And the thing that is particularly galling, of course, is that we have deliberately, for a very long time, denied ourselves the opportunity to field the technology that we have. This was something that Undersecretary Mike Griffin, of whom I am a great admirer too, actually talked about on our program recently. His frustrations that we have not taken advantage of technologies that we've invented to protect ourselves. And I know you agree, Angelo, that that means having the capability to stop Russia and Chinese missiles from being able to attack our homeland, something, again, we've to this point declined to do. Angelo, there is so much more to talk about. I hope you'll come back very soon. I'm so grateful to you for the incredibly important insights that you've shared with us. Come back to us again soon. I hope the rest of you will come back to us again tomorrow, same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.